The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning and welcome to the show, everybody. It's Monday morning, the 14th of November. This is Richard Martin, the wake-up call. And without further ado, let's move right in on the information that I have for you, which is basically concerned with Greece. Last week, as you know, I spoke about Italy and its problems. Today, I'm going to talk about Greece and give you some background to its own problems. All right, well, let's start with the question as to why Greece is in debt. Well, like any state or person for that matter, it spent more money than it took in. Now, traditionally, but especially after switching over to the euro, the Greek government paid out huge amounts of cash it simply didn't have. And to compound this, the retirement age there is low by modern Western standards, and benefits are generous. Public sector employees are well paid. Now, this would be bad enough on its own, but the problem is further compounded by the fact that Greece is also infamous for mass tax evasion. That, of course, means severely limited revenue. So when the money ran out, Athens turned to European banks for loans. Soon, the government was borrowing billions, and those debts, like some prime mortgages in the United States, were often repackaged and sold off around the continent. Everyone, especially banks in France and Germany, wanted a piece. Well, now they have it. So why does Europe, and indeed the world, care so much about Greece's debts? One of the perceived perks when Europe got together on a single currency, Greeks, for example, gave up the drachma for the euro, was that a strong Europe could prop up an individual state in a time of need. But what's happened is that Europe itself has become too weak in the aftermath of the global financial meltdown to bite the bullet on a country like Greece. A default would shatter otherwise monetarily strong countries like Germany. The Germans, like the Americans, would be left with a host of too big to fail banks ready to do just that. So let's have a look at the kind of deal the European Union has offered the Greeks. Have been a few already, and certainly a handful more are in the works, but it boils down to this. European banks will forgive 50 cents for every dollar owed to them by the Greek government. In exchange, Greece must impose what many have described as a crushing austerity. That means no more early retirement, reduced pay for public workers, the ones who manage to keep their jobs, large-scale cuts to social programs, and a staggered repayment of the reduced debt. Now, you may know that the ex-Prime Minister Papandreou originally called for a referendum. As you might imagine, austerity is a dirty word in large parts of Greece. Many people there believe the country is being unfairly affected by reckless spending and subsequent cutbacks by the government. Papandreou clearly didn't want to be the guy everyone blamed for taking the European Union deal. So he proposed a vote, a referendum. This seriously worried the rest of Europe with fears that Greek voters would spike the bailout. The Prime Minister's decision was scrapped after foreign leaders and some influential Greek politicians put pressure on his governing coalition, which ultimately fell last week. Loukas Papademos is now Prime Minister. You may be wondering why the Greeks are so reluctant to take the bailout. Pete Marici, a professor at the Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland and former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission, explained it rather well in his latest column, and I quote, "In exchange for aid from richer European Union governments, Greeks must accept draconian austerity measures. These would further drive up unemployment and shrink Greece's economy and tax base at an alarming pace, placing in jeopardy eventual repayment of Athens's remaining debt. As currently constituted, a single currency may serve the One Europe designs of France and Germany, but make Greece and the other Mediterranean states nothing more than the victims of a northern conquest." End of quote. Well, Greeks who oppose the deal, and even many who support it only as a means of staying a member of the European Union, don't want to end up like an American post-grad forever in debt to the banks that provided college loans. So, you may ask, what would happen if Greece defaulted on its foreign debt? It's extremely important to understand that what happens in Greece will be seen as the way forward for a number of other countries, Spain, Portugal, and Ireland, to name a few. Some believe Italy could follow suit. Default by the Greeks would likely mean other sovereign states to follow. Strictly within Greece, it wouldn't be as bad, relatively speaking. They would drop the euro and return to the drachma, which would in turn be severely devalued. Not great news for Greek tourists planning on a trip abroad anytime soon, but very good for exports, which would become extremely cheap, like those coming out of China or other smaller developing markets. Outside Greece, it would be a big mess. German banks, and maybe French too, would need massive bailouts. The prospect of those defaults in other debt-ridden countries could cause a run on the banks. Even more money would leave the market. And when money leaves the market, demand drops. When demand drops, economies crater. If, on the other hand, Greece accepts the EU deal, Greece will see its debt cut in half and be made to enforce the tough austerity discussed before. There will almost certainly be deadly riots. Banks around Europe will take what is known as a haircut, or a sizable loss, but remain technically solvent, at least for the moment. Greece would pay over time, but most of the money right now will come out of a fund sponsored by the stronger state economies from Europe and the IMF. In short, everyone will relax, safe in the knowledge that the global financial system we've all come to know and, well, the system we've come to know would keep on spinning for at least another day. You see, the basic problem is that Greece has insufficient economic growth. It has enormous deficits, nearly 14% of GDP. It has a heavy existing debt burden as a proportion of GDP, over 120%, accruing at high interest rates, about 8%, payable in a currency that it is unable to devalue. This creates a violation of what economists call the transversality or no Ponzi condition. In order to pay off credibly, The debt has to have a well-defined present value. Technically, the present value of the future debt should vanish if you look far enough into the future. Unless Greece implements enormous fiscal austerity, its debt will grow faster than the rate that investors use to discount it back to present value. Meanwhile, the planned 50% haircut on Greek debt does not include official debt to the IMF and the European Central Bank, which, as I noted last week, contributes to the question of whether the 50% figure will actually hold up, particularly given that Greek debt at every maturity is already trading at a 38 handle or less, and the one-year yield is now up to a record 220%. All right, ladies and gentlemen, so let me, with that, give you my information, starting with our phone number, which is, I'm sure you all know it by heart by now, ladies and gentlemen, it is 888-874-4888. That is our toll-free number for you to call in and give us your peace of mind. Okay, once again, the toll-free number, 888-874-4888. If you want to email me, the email address is open and ready to accept your emails to the following address, rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. That's again rm@gfawd.com. And finally, my personal direct line to my office is 941, area code 441-1682. Again, that's 941-441-1682. All right, well now, just a very quick comment, an observation, if you like, on the horrendous nature of what is happening in the United States in terms of the intrusive nature of your government. Now, I've spoken about this before. It's not a political comment of any type. It is a very simple economic function of what it is that you think a government should be responsible for, as opposed to what the free market or the people themselves should define as their own responsibility. But what I think you're going to agree with, once you've heard the clip that I'm about to play you, is that government employment and crazy spending have just gone totally wild and out of control. It is very shocking. Again, it doesn't really impinge on your own personal political views and opinions. It is just a horrendous fact of life that government has not just encroached on your lives, but it has, in many respects, completely taken them over. And I just want to hear you, I want you to hear what somebody has to say about this, along with a few interesting statistics. So with that, let's go straight to the clip that has been prepared for your enjoyment.
We keep on hearing that if we want to get Congress back on track to representing us, that we need to get the special interest out of politics. And I wholeheartedly agree. But what most fail to realize is that government itself is its own special interest and will do and or say almost anything to protect itself. Now stay tuned, because at the end of this video, I'm going to show you why our freedoms may be at stake if we don't cut government soon. Our federal government has seen an explosion in its size over the last 10 years, and both political parties are to blame for this. How big has it grown? Over the last decade, the number of private sector employees has grown only 1%. But the number of federal government employees has grown 15%. We are now out of the era of big government and into the era of enormous government. Basically, Congress used this recession to expand government and entrench government workers. When this recession started, while you are worrying about paying the bills and keeping a roof over your family's head, the Transportation Department had one. Just one employee making over $170,000 a year. Today, that number is 1,690 employees. When this recession started, while you are worrying about keeping your job and putting food on your table, the Department of Defense had 1,868 employees making over $150,000 a year. Today, that number is 10,100 employees. In fact, when this recession started, the number of federal employees making more than $100,000 a year doubled in less than 2 years. And when you include salary and benefits, the average total compensation for a private sector employee in 2009 was $61,000. Now, take a guess what the average total compensation for a federal government employee was in 2009. A whopping $123,000, more than double that in the private sector. Do you really think these people will vote against any spending cuts? Now, this is the important part. There are approximately 21,300,000 government employees in this country. We'll talk about special interests. About 16% of this nation's voting electorate works for government. And most people have at least one person close to them, like a spouse, who will vote with them in an effort to keep their job. Well, that means at least 32% of the voting electorate will come out and vote against anyone who talks openly about spending cuts. And when that number hits 50%, well, it's game over, folks. And then we, the people, will be in the permanent minority. And therein lies the hidden danger of big government. Now, the only way we can make a difference is if people hear this message. Please forward this video to everyone you know before we wake up one day and it's too late.
Okay, well, as you heard, that was a video, but really there was nothing to see except the guy's face, and so I deemed it appropriate to bring it to you as an audio clip, and I hope you enjoyed it. I think it speaks for itself. I'm not going to go into details as to what is acceptable and what isn't, because that really does start to get political, but you will make your own decisions, ladies and gentlemen, and your own conclusions according to what you think. But I personally think that all things considered, that those figures are stupefying. I would be very scared to go and live in a country where those figures were presented to me as being the normal progress of government intrusion into our lives from an economic point of view. But anyway, that's for another day. Well, I got an email from Bill Sheehan saying as follows: Richard, I heard Gerald Celente say that he had commodities positions through a brokerage that was owned by MF Global. He said he was called up on a margin call and found out that the funds in the account were inaccessible because they were now held by a trustee. In spite of the lack of particulars, can you explain what seems to be going on and what lessons there are for the rest of us? Thanks, Bill Sheehan. Well, actually, that dovetails in with my previous intention, before I actually received this email, to try to explain what the current horror of the MF Global situation is for those unfortunate customers who have sort of got caught in the web here. It requires me just simply to explain a little bit about what MF Global does. I think it's interesting. Hopefully you will find out, you know, just what a terrible dilemma this is when I've explained this. But a commodities futures firm sells contracts in commodity futures. Now, they don't actually sell the commodities themselves. They sell the rights to take delivery or to make delivery of those commodities at a future date according to contracts that you can buy through the exchanges. If you buy, for example, a gold contract that gives you the right to buy gold at a certain price, it gives you the right to buy 100 ounces of gold, which is what one contract represents, at a future date. The current future date is February. The date after that would be April and then June. And so what happens when you are a client of a commodities futures firm is that you put up a deposit, which is usually somewhere in the region of, 5 to 8% of the value of that commodity. Now, when I look at gold right now, I see that gold is trading at the December contract, actually, which is the current close contract, is trading at 1,778 multiplied by 100, which is basically $177,800, which is what one contract of gold is worth. That's 100 times 1 ounce of gold at 1,778 comes to $177,800. Now, if you put up, say, 8% of that, you're putting up about $14,000. So every client has two things going for him. He has put up a deposit, in this case $14,000, and he has a contract to buy or take delivery of 100 ounces of gold in February at a price of $1,778 an ounce. Now, what happened with MF Global was that they went bankrupt, simply bankrupt, overnight, and they went bankrupt. So all the clients now find themselves with their open contracts, which could lose value because the contract right now is indeed worth $177,800 an ounce. But what if it goes down to, say, $1,500 an ounce? Then you have 1,500 times 100. The contract is suddenly worth only $150,000. So you're down, $20,000 or $30,000. Now, if your broker is bankrupt, but you still have your contract, you're in very serious trouble because you can't sell your contract because your broker's gone out of business. So what do you do? Well, this was Gerald Celente's problem, because what happened was they transferred all the MF Global accounts to other brokers. Now, they transferred the contracts to other brokers, but unfortunately, the money to cover them, the deposit that I've mentioned to you, has been frozen at MF Global. So now, the contract and the deposit to cover that contract have been separated. So now, I'm assuming that poor Gerald has got a contract in one house, and he has frozen money at another house. But the new house also wants a deposit for the contract that it has on hand. So what does Gerald do? Either he has to bring up again another $14,000 for his one contract of gold, and maybe he has 10 or 20, in which case it comes into maybe several hundred thousand dollars worth of deposit money for his contracts. Or his contracts will be sold, and he may be sitting on huge losses, which he will have to pay for. And remember, MF Global still has his money. So this is a very, very serious problem indeed. I can't remember, and I was in commodity futures for many, many years, I don't remember having seen this situation before. This is quite new, and it is very, very serious indeed, and many people are going to be wiped out from this, and I feel for Gerald. I don't know what his situation is, but it is as bad as anybody has been told that it is. Nobody can possibly exaggerate the seriousness of this. Bill asks what the lessons are for the rest of us. I don't know that there are any particular lessons that one can draw from this, Bill, because you can't know that any particular broker is suddenly going to go bankrupt overnight. So you can't. You really can't protect yourself against this eventuality. And when it comes to commodity futures trading, I can assure you the stakes are always going to be very great. and you basically risking, it appears, something which would have been thought of as unthinkable as little as 2 weeks ago. So I don't know what the answer is to that, Bill. I don't know what lessons there are. If you want to trade and if you want to be a commodity futures speculator, it looks like you're going to have to take the consequences if things go wrong. I don't see any other alternative. It is a very serious problem, and certainly it will have dramatic effects on confidence in the markets. We have not heard the end of this. And we still don't know where the money is that got lost, euphemistically described, at MS Global, $600 million of commodity clients' money, which was supposed to be segregated, has apparently just disappeared. Has it been stolen? Has it been placed in other accounts? We have no idea. We still don't know yet. But whatever the situation, is very grim, and I appreciate very much you having brought our attention to this, Bill. Hopefully you have got your answer. All right, well, got another email from Zaid, who says, "Good evening, Richard. I'm listening to your Thursday show right now. Is there a meetup group in L.A.? Do you know of any listeners on the West Coast? Thanks, Zaid." Well, Zaid, so far there isn't a meetup group in L.A., but if you want to start one, you're very welcome to do so. I'm not sure how many listeners I have on the West Coast, but if any of the listeners on the West Coast would like to contact Zaid, please let me know, and I will make sure you get in contact with him. Just once more, I will give you my email address so that you can write to me in this regard. It is rm@gfawd.com. That's GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. rm@gfawd.com. If you want to join or rather set up a meetup group to talk about what to do in the present situation, especially with an emphasis on emigrating from the United States, then please feel free to get in touch with me, and I will put you in touch with Zaid. So thank you for your interest, Zaid. Very, very nice. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've only got about 2 minutes to the break, so I think rather than embark upon a new idea, I've got plenty of those for you, I think we will just take our break right now, and then we'll start afresh at the half hour. Be right back. Okay, I think we're back. I will know soon enough whether I'm right or not. Well, do you remember the $8,000 bribe the government offered to people to buy a new home when they were doing cash for clunkers? Well, Zillow.com, the real estate information company, says the average price for an American home fell again last month to $171,500, which is the lowest level in 8 years. Now, that's down 4.4% from a year ago, although it's been about stable over the summer. Now, compare the average prices with those that people paid in 2009 and 2010 when they took advantage of the credits. According to Zillow, prices during that time averaged about $186,000. In other words, based at least on average prices, you'd have lost about $14,500, nearly twice the value of the credit. Stan Humphries, Zillow's chief economist, says the credits effectively expired in June 2010 when prices nationwide averaged $182,000. Well, since then, we're down $10,500. The biggest losers? Step forward all those who took up Uncle Sam's $8,000 bribe and rushed out to buy a new home in Santa Barbara, California. You have already lost $50,000 of your $440,000 investment. And that's even counting the $8,000 bribe. Well, that was courtesy of Andy Celsius. Thank you very much, Andy, for that. You know, most analysts will tell you that negative equity is the number one problem in the housing market today, even worse than foreclosures, because it causes foreclosures, stymies consumer spending, and traps potential home buyers and sellers in place. Negative equity rose to 28.6% of single-family homes with mortgages in the third quarter of this year, according to Zillow. That's up from 26.8% in the second quarter. In real terms, that's 14.6 million borrowers. Many of those borrowers are already behind on their mortgage payments, and some are likely already in the foreclosure process. The rest of them are in danger of defaulting, not because they can't pay their mortgages, but because they either won't want to, seeing as they will never see any real appreciation in their investment, or because any change in their economic or personal situation might force them into default, such as a change of job or divorce. While 14.6 million might seem like a lot, it's not the real number when you consider negative equity in housing's recovery. That's because it doesn't factor in effective negative equity, which is borrowers who have so little equity in their homes that they cannot afford to move. This is what mortgage analyst Mark Hansen has to say. On U.S. totals, if you figure average house prices using conforming loan balances, then a repeat buyer has to have roughly 10% down to buy in addition to the 6% realtor fee to sell. Thus, the effective negative equity target would be 85%. You also have to factor in secondary financing, which most measures leave out. Based on that, over 50% of all mortgaged households in the U.S. are effectively underwater, unable to sell for enough to pay a realtor and put a down payment on a new purchase without coming out of pocket. Because repeat buyers have always carried the market as the foundation, this is why demand has not come back. It's as if half the potential buyers in America died over a two-year period of time. The foreclosure crisis grabs most of the media attention these days, but in order for housing to recover, the market needs to see activity. It's as simple as buying and selling. Negative and effective negative equity are causing stagnation, which may in the end be far more detrimental than foreclosures. The argument to solve this problem is principal forgiveness, and it is gaining traction politically and somewhat less in the banking sector. Principal forgiveness, or lowering the balance of a large chunk of the nation's mortgages, would be costly at best, but could be catastrophic at worst. And I quote again from Hansen, "Those thinking principal reductions are a panacea have never originated alone, done the street-level research, and do not really know the borrowers behind their data. More than likely, it would create a far greater number of new strategic defaulters than the number it would legitimately save from foreclosure." End of quote. As we've seen that the jobless rate, where the broadest measure of unemployment is 80% higher than the headline statistic, and with retail sales, where the reported figure is much less than it seems when population growth and inflation are taken into account, you can't believe much of what you see or hear these days. So too, with data on the ever-sinking housing market, which continues to stand in the way of any sort of meaningful recovery. In a recent article entitled, "Half of U.S. Mortgages Are Effectively Underwater," CNBC's Realty Check cites research from mortgage analyst Mark Hansen suggesting that the equity position of U.S. home owners, a euphemism if ever I heard one, is far worse than the official tallies would have you believe. On U.S. totals, if you figure average house prices use conforming loan balances, then a repeat buyer has to have roughly 10% down to buy in addition to the 6% realtor fee to sell. Thus, the effective negative equity target would be 85%. You also have to factor in secondary financing, which most measures leave out. Well, here's another example of statistics which misrepresent the truth. In September, half of the retail sales gains were in autos. Yet auto sales are counted when cars are shipped to dealers, not when they are sold to consumers. Chrysler Group's LLC's October U.S. auto sales rose 27%. For example, Chevrolet sales rose 6%. But in an admission that what I've just told you about sales being clocked when cars are shipped to dealers, dealer inventory was up 15% at GM from a year ago and up 6.1% from September. So the key takeaway from last month's so-called good General Motors sales report is that it was largely based on nothing more than channel stuffing. Okay, well, we see what I might have for you here. We do seem to have an email. From Adrian, it says, Richard, my bet is this is the end of the so-called Obamacare. Watch the insurance companies screw the American public yet again. Adrian. And he is referring to a Supreme Court coming ruling on care reform law. This is what the it says. The Supreme Court has announced it will consider the Affordable Care Act, ACA, during its current session. Oral arguments are expected to be heard this spring. All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Adrian. You could well be right. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I've talked about fractional reserve banking many times on the wake-up call, so I really don't want to rehash it here. But I think it's worth an observation on the consequences of this terrible system of money creation that's been prevalent in the United States for almost exactly 100 years. You see, here's the scheme. The bankers indebt the people of nations by using their own money systems. The creation of money by government's proxies is nothing more than a debt owed to private individuals, which is both completely unnecessary and utterly insane. The people must work to pay back principal and interest on that totally artificial debt. But there's so much of it, they can't possibly do that. The math is impossible. So according to those who think over-indebted and bankrupt countries deserve a second chance, albeit utterly futile, the central bankers are apparently supposed to create money from nothing with the sole purpose of buying up that debt. So my question, and hopefully yours, should be obvious and is very simple. Why not just have the government create money in the first place without recourse to private financial organizations like the Fed and the banks and the corresponding debt? Do you see the circular nature of what the U.S. and other countries are doing by having these private organizations like the Fed create money along with their cronies, the big banks, and lending it out at interest? The circle feeds the private few at the expense of the many, all for absolutely no justifiable reason whatsoever. The whole thing is truly and absolutely insane, and once again, we're talking about the root problem, not only economically, but morally, and we're talking about the proper rule of law. The markets are so far from free that it is frankly laughable. Don't look at the Constitution when it comes to money. Congress is required to, quote, regulate the value thereof. And that simple clause doesn't give them permission to sell out one of the most important facets of the Constitution to a few private bankers. The whole thing is sick. Well, a new Wall Street Journal poll suggests that Americans have woken up to the extreme inequality that has developed in the country in the past 3 decades, in which the richest Americans have gotten much richer while everyone else has stayed in place or lost ground. 60% of the poll's respondents believe that the current structure of the economy favors a small portion of the rich over the rest of the country. They also think that the power of major banks and corporations should be curtailed, and that the government shouldn't subsidize or bail out companies. None of that is surprising given the bailouts of recent years. What is surprising, or at least disheartening, is that the same Americans continue to believe that they can have it all. For example, 53% of Americans believe that debt and deficits should be cut significantly. But the same percentage agrees that taxes should not be raised on anyone. Similarly, 53% of Americans think that the influence of banks and corporations should be reined in, but that regulations of businesses should be pared back. In other words, Americans want everything. Yes, most of those who believe that debt and deficits should be cut probably think that the way to do it is simply through spending cuts, not tax increases. But it's hard to imagine how the necessary debt reduction could be achieved just through spending cuts without hammering the economy or cutting into services that Americans want. Non-partisan economists generally think that deficits should be reduced through a combination of spending cuts and tax increases. It's very hard to imagine that America will find a way out of its economic predicament that doesn't involve significant pain of one sort or another. But it doesn't appear that most Americans have woken up to that. You know, in the USSR in 1988, nobody had a clue that everything would be over in less than a year. And quite frankly, I think it's the same in America. People don't disappear, all factories don't close, but a massive change and chaotic transition occurs. I also expect the same in Europe, with some revolution or coups in some countries, big institutional changes, massive defaults and bankruptcies in both banks and the leveraged corporate sector, returning to some state nations or forming of several blocs. But the European Monetary Union won't exist as it is even 1 year. Most realistic analysts say 5 years. I think it goes further than the EMU, and we can include the UK, the US, and perhaps even Japan, perhaps even the entire Western world with it, with a short 1 to 2 year lag at the very most. And you know what happens after that, ladies and gentlemen? It's war. Well, Goldman Sachs on Friday came out with this bleak comment about the economy in 2012, and I quote, "We are particularly concerned about 2 potential negative shocks, one of which has already materialized to some degree. First, a worsening of the European financial crisis would hurt the economic outlook globally. Second, our forecast assumes that the payroll tax cut is extended for another year. If that failed to happen, the fiscal drag in early 2012 would rise significantly." End of quote. Well, that's in addition to their bleak 1% forecast for 2012 GDP growth. And in addition to that, I'd say that oil and gas prices are phenomenally high for October and November, Actually, they're the highest ever for these 2 months. Ongoing state and local government cutbacks won't help. 232,000 jobs have been cut already this year. California's revenues are $810.5 million below recent projections. Cuts are bound to follow there, and they're bound to follow in other states too. The housing crisis shows no signs of ending, with house prices continuing to fall and more distressed supply coming onto the market. As you can see, it's a never-ending, ongoing snowball effect, as one grim statistic creates another in its wake. This is all part of the unraveling, which will take years to play itself out. Anybody who says they'd know how long it will take or how bad it will get is lying. It's impossible to gauge the extent of collapse which lies ahead. The only reliable comment one can make is that the longer governments try to fight this, the harder will be the fall and the longer it will take to arrest it. This is simply because all the while this is playing out, by adding new debt, which is the only thing these idiots know how to do to prolong the agony, the debt situation at all levels will grow and become that much harder to curtail. So, ladies and gentlemen, be warned. All right. Well, frankly, I would suggest that virtually no bad news is priced into the stock market right now. After all, despite the fact that the U.S. unemployment is at 9%, virtually the entire Middle East is in turmoil. China's growth is slowing and the European Union is in deep trouble. Yet the Standard & Poor's 500 is trading above where it was on the day Bear Stearns went under. As to the issues enveloping the European Union, note that the original impetus for its formation was to prevent another European war, not necessarily to create a fiscal or political entity. Anybody with half a brain could tell you that trying to fold 15 to 25 countries with different cultures and different languages into a single fiscal and political entity was going to be a rather tenuous proposition at best. And nobody who has studied European history should be at least surprised at what is currently happening. The European Union is facing for the first time the ultimate question, to unite or to divorce. And at the same time, it's trying to save its insolvent banks, which have five times the assets of United States banks, as it faces tremendous imbalances between surplus countries and deficit countries. The USA is at least as leveraged as Greece, and probably more than Italy. This destruction of the euro is the necessary prelude to a huge US devaluation. We are looking at a massive aggravation of the current Great Depression, version 2.0. Okay, well, Bill wrote in and he said as follows. My dear friend Mr. Martin, we have talked twice on PRN and once on your personal line. I became a first-time listener in October 2011 and have been preparing for and anticipating complete global environmental and economic collapse since the late 1970s. That's a mouthful. A couple of questions and comments, if you please. How is it that the U.S. markets are staying relatively stable and not crashing? I can't imagine the average person in the market doesn't see or hear or read all the news about what's happening. Do they just believe the talking troika heads when they say, we will solve the problem, we have a solution, and the like? Or are the markets somehow simply being controlled by computers? Dow Jones Industrials up 300, down 300, up 300, etc.? Well, let me just answer that question quickly, Bill. I think that people are living in a state of total denial. In fact, I am certain of it. There is absolutely not the slightest justification for these elevated levels in the market, and I am quite sure that they will collapse. It's just a question of time, and I think that time is growing dangerously close. Denial is indeed more than just a river in Egypt. Okay, question number two from Bill. If I'm not mistaken, I believe your position is to be strong on dollars as compared to physical gold, ETF gold if a chunk of the money is trapped in a 401k. I was wondering how your view might compare to, and then he gives a huge long link to a website. And what about the idea that there is 100 times more paper gold than physical gold? Well, that's true, Bill. There is much more paper gold, that's to say contracts of gold, contracts along the lines of what I was talking about earlier in the program, contracts to buy or sell gold at a given price, on the maturity of which you can expect to receive mountains of gold piling up inside your outside your front door. That's what contracts are and what is known as paper gold. So there's probably a lot more than 100 times more paper gold than physical gold, Bill, but I won't argue the point. I do nevertheless believe that all this is going to collapse along with all other assets and values against money, so I would be very cautious about holding gold, as you know. Number three, question number three. Some background, so I could mention peak oil. From a young age, I didn't believe the lies and propaganda as put forth by mainstream society. Why would I want to store a bottle of cyanide on a shelf next to the cooking spices, even if the lid is on tightly? Nuclear power, for example. Anyway, I've been following peak oil for decades. I got a bachelor's in petroleum engineering in 1983, also for reference, degrees in engineering science and mechanics and electrical engineering. And I am convinced of its reality. I know you may not feel as such, but when I look at global production and exploration, push for tar sands, two-for-one energy return, Saudi Arabia unable to ramp up production, deep water and Arctic exploration, the U.S. invasion of the Middle East and now North Africa, CIA ops, etc., well, it seems inescapable. I personally feel there is no place to run except away from large population centers. This letter is written with deep respect, appreciation, and admiration. You and your family would always be welcome in our home. Sincerely, Bill. Well, thank you, Bill. That's a very kind gesture. And hey, watch out. You never know. I might take you up on it. Okay. Well, you know, the insatiable demand for cash by governments and creditors is overwhelming the system's ability to come up with it. Governments, banks, and consumers are all desperate for cash. Up until recently, gold is described as an asset that responds not so much to inflation as to financial instability. It was supposed to be a safe haven in times of financial instability. Today's action in gold prices does not affirm that, however. Today we have more news of financial instability than ever, and gold didn't react. The boast of modern economists has been that modern government and modern banks, through deficit spending and interest rate cuts, could stop people from hoarding cash. These actions, they asserted, would restore the people's confidence so that they would start spending again. Ironically, as government and the financial sector have grown, their insatiable demands for cash have screwed the consumer. Far from being a confident spender, the consumer today is a debt and tax slave, desperately trying to come up with enough cash each month to stay out of bankruptcy. Ladies and gentlemen, I see no green shoots, no animal spirits, just continued demands for astronomical sums of cash and a broken down banking system increasingly incapable of generating fresh fiat. That is why, in my opinion, cash, not gold, is king. So we will have to agree to differ with a lot of the people who believe that oil prices are headed for the moon, that gold is headed for the moon. I'm afraid that the concept of deflation is far, far more deleterious than most people would imagine just by looking at the figures. And I think it always comes down to the same thing. The problem is not deflation or inflation per se, but it is the unexpected consequences of these different realities that people simply cannot come to terms with. And that's what's going to hurt over time. And that's what people have to understand when it comes to deciding which prices are going to go higher, which prices are going to go lower. Is the stock market going to go up? Is it going to go down? That's what you're concerned with. You're concerned with what people are able to spend. And it doesn't matter in the end what the government does. It doesn't matter how much money they spend. And you're seeing it, as I mentioned to you earlier on in the show, the horrendous way in which government is overtaking our lives. And in the clip I played you earlier on, in the end, if the consumer doesn't consume, the economy is toast. And everything within the economy is toast with it. And I do hope you will get this, ladies and gentlemen. At one point, if I have said this once, I've said it 1,000 times. The consumer is king. The government is only an enabler. It does not direct society. It does not control your life. That's what communism was all about. It tried to control your destiny, but the consumer never had the wherewithal to buy anything, so it didn't work. And the sooner these governments come to understand that, the sooner the problem will be dealt with, it will go away, and the economy will begin to generate itself once again. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, this is, of course, the end of the show, and I hope you all have a wonderful week ahead. I will be back on Friday, as usual, same place, same time. This is Richard Martin at The Wake Up Call saying bye-bye. Till then.